We're talking about flooding and the potential for well contamination on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Department of Natural Resources is encouraging private well owners to test to ensure safe drinking water and assume a well is contaminated if floodwaters cover the well. Do you get your drinking water from a private well? And if so, have you had water quality issues this spring from all of the flooding? How often do you test the quality of your well water? We're at 800-642-1234. Lisa Lehman is a private water section chief for the Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater at the Wisconsin DNR. Lisa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So we've seen snow, we've seen rain, freezing rain, a ton of snow melt, a lot more rain. What kind of toll is this taking on our private wells?
Well, we're hearing, of course, throughout the state, people are being evacuated or experiencing flooding, and the combination of the wet fall last year, heavy snowpack this winter, and then our recent, you know, quick warm up and rain has really caused the flooding to happen quickly. And if people's wells are in low-lying areas or in floodplains, they're going to be especially vulnerable to having flooding.
So explain how that works. How does flooding put wells at risk?
Well, floodwater and rain runoff contains bacteria and other contaminants. It can get into a well if the floodwater flows around a well or, in some cases, even over the top of a well. Also, older wells that maybe are in a basement or if they don't have a good seal on their well cap can also be vulnerable to contamination.
So is this the riskiest time of year for people who rely on water from private wells?
It does tend to be a risky year. Usually we have warming temperatures, snow melt, sometimes some lingering frozen ground at this time of year. But especially this year, because of that heavy snow pack and the quick melt, it's especially a concern this year.
Lisa, what are some signs that a well is contaminated?
Well, two big things we encourage people to look for at this time of year. Number one, if you do see flood water around your well or going over the top of it, you should assume that your well is contaminated. But another thing that people can do is just look for any change in the color, smell, or the taste of their water coming out of the tap.
And what kind of contaminants are we talking about here?
Well, bacteria is present in the environment all around us, but we don't want it getting into our drinking water and consuming it because that can make us sick. So bacteria, different types of bacteria are the main things that we're concerned about. But depending on your landscape, there can be other contaminants that can be in that runoff and melt water.
What are the possible impact on human health here as you look at this flooding and the impact on private wells?
Well, bacteria can make people sick in a number of different ways, depending on what other contaminants might be in the water. But bacteria is what we would call an acute contaminant. It will make you sick right away. You know, it would be anything from stomach or digestive upset. And so those are the kinds of things that we want people to be aware, especially if they've been evacuated and then are coming back into their home. You know, don't assume that your drinking water is safe and take some steps to take some caution about that.
We're talking with Lisa Lehman. She is the private water section chief for the Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater at the Wisconsin DNR. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you get your drinking water from a private well? And if so, have you had water quality issues this spring from the flooding? And what questions do you have about your well water? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. So let's talk about testing. How often should well users be testing their water?
Well, in general, we encourage people to test their private well water once a year for bacteria and on a regular basis for nitrate and arsenic, which are other contaminants that we consider to be acute health risks. And again, people can also look at what's in their surrounding landscape, what other contaminants might they be concerned about. But bacteria is the number one because that's an indicator that maybe the well is doesn't have the integrity that it used to, and it could be vulnerable to other contaminations if it tests positive for bacteria.
How do you go about getting a well tested?
Testing your well is pretty easy. You can contact a local laboratory that will do that analysis for you. They'll send you a test kit with instructions for how to do the sampling. If you don't feel confident about it, you can also hire a licensed well professional to help you.
And let's say a test turns up contamination. How do you go about treating the problem?
If a test, well test comes back positive for bacteria, the next step is to disinfect that water. If you've had a flood water over your well, it's really important to wait until those waters recede before you disinfect the well, because it may not last and you may have to disinfect it again. So once the flood waters recede, then you can work with a licensed professional to disinfect your well and then wait for that disinfection to take effect and sample the well to make sure that the water is safe before you start drinking it again.
So are you flushing the well? How does that disinfection, how does that go?
Right. The disinfection, and again, a licensed professional knows the right steps to follow. It's generally a chlorine-based substance that they'll use for the well disinfection. And then it needs to be flushed throughout the system, but then remain in the system for a while to make sure that all the bacteria is killed and not reproducing again. So there is some waiting time after the initial disinfection. Then that chlorine gets flushed out of the system so you can sample the well and check and make sure that it's safe.
During this time of flooding, are there any city water systems that are impacted or larger systems that really have to keep an eye on what's going on in groundwater?
Public water utilities tend to have an emergency management plan, and so they've got steps in place and ready to go if they do experience some flooding. Larger utilities have more than one well, so they have the ability to make sure that if they do have any flooding that's impacting the water supply, that they have ways to address that. But for a private well owner, you're really the manager of your own utility. So that's why we really want to make sure that private well owners know what steps that they need to watch out for and what steps they can take to make sure their water is safe.
And we're having this conversation because of this immediate risk to private wells in the state due to the flooding emergency. But what other steps should homeowners routinely do to protect themselves all year long?
Well, as I mentioned, it's important for people to test their well once a year. That's really the only way that you know the quality of your drinking water is by testing it. You can also keep an eye out all year long. Notice any changes in the taste, color, or odor of your drinking water that might signal that there's a problem. Be aware of where your well is located and make sure you keep any sources of contamination away from it. So you don't want your downspout from your roof running right past your well. You don't want to have your pets or pet waste areas near your well, for example. And if you have any concerns, you know, certainly if you observe some changes or have a concern, test your well water, or you can even have your well inspected by a licensed well professional to make sure that the cap and the seal are intact.
Lisa, where can well owners go for more information?
DNR has a webpage with lots of good information for well owners. It's starting at our homepage, dnr.wi.gov. Just type in the word wells. We've got information about, you know, proper well construction, how to test your well, and other hopefully useful tips for people in maintaining their private well.
Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Lisa Lehman is the Private Water Section Chief for the Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Up next, hospitals are looking for ways to reduce the number of repeat overdoses involving opioids. We'll talk to a Wisconsin-based nonprofit about its approach to guiding people through recovery. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about drug recovery coaches in a new pilot program here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The state's rate of drug and opioid overdoses exceeds the national average, and some hospitals are staffing drug recovery coaches. They're on call 24/7 to meet face-to-face with patients recovering in the ER from an overdose. Do you or someone you love have a problem with opioid abuse? What is your story? You can share at 800-642-1234. Dr. Julie Denier is an emergency medicine specialist at St. Joseph's Hospital in Milwaukee, which is part of the Ascension Healthcare System. She applied for a $75,000 grant from WISHOPE to provide drug recovery coaches for three Milwaukee hospitals. Dr. Denier, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having us here, Kate. We're excited to be here.
And Peter Brunzel is here as well. He's executive director of WISHOPE. That's a Waukesha County nonprofit that offers drug recovery coaches as well as education and support to Wisconsin communities. Peter, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Peter, let's start with you. Several Milwaukee hospitals are now offering drug recovery coaches. What are these recovery coaches doing? What's their role?
The recovery coach's role has a few different things as far as resources and bringing people to community supports as well as treatment. Recovery coaches offer support during typically the most vulnerable time in someone's life, if we're speaking specifically towards the ER, when that's the period of sometimes stigma and judgment is what they may feel they're going to experience, but the recovery coach is very non-judgmental, but actually has empathy and compassion because they are a peer, and they know how to outline that path for the person and also open the door to whatever pathway they're looking for in their life and their recovery.
And they're not just a sheet of paper, perhaps, with a list of names and phone numbers to take the next step. They're an actual person holding your hand.
They are, and they will be there for you the day after the ER, as well as the next 365 days or more.
Reminds me of organizations like Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous having sponsors. Sponsors are recovered addicts that give support and mentorship. How are recovery coaches different from AA or NA sponsors?
Sure, absolutely. So recovery coach is a trained professional. They just start with a 40-hour training that includes 30 CEUs, and they are also receiving ongoing training and supervision. We host a plethora of trainings throughout the year. If someone's interested in one of these trainings, they can go to our website online, www.wishope.org.
Dr. Denier, tell us about the relationship between a recovery coach and other medical professionals in that ER. How are people working together?
The recovery coaches just have a special skill that we don't have. You mentioned earlier that we have, prior to our relationship with our recovery coaches, we would meet somebody with an opioid problem. And how we typically met somebody in our emergency departments are through a few reasons. They would come into our emergency department after an opioid overdose, or if they came in saying they're struggling with opioid addiction, or we kind of look at their chart and realize that they are looking for opiates. So once we've discovered that, we can treat them medically. We can treat their overdose. We can treat their addiction symptoms, their withdrawal symptoms. But the piece that we were missing, and it was really frustrating to us, that we didn't feel like we're connecting with them on a personal level. Medicine, as we know, we love to treat people, but sometimes we can be a little paternalistic. And even when we, on our best days, we can come across as a little paternalistic, a little judgmental, even if we're not trying. The recovery coaches really have a special skill of connecting with a person in crisis. When they're in the emergency department, they're in a special place of crisis, and this is such a great time for them to connect with somebody who's walked in their shoes, who can talk to them about what's coming up and help them through the process of hopefully getting some help and starting on the road to recovery.
So, Dr. Denier, how does a patient get matched with a coach in the ER? The ER is a really busy place. There's a lot going on. How do you make a match?
Our recovery coaches make it really easy for us. And you have identified another big hurdle that we have. The ER is a crazy place. It's busy. When I'm seeing a patient, I've got to get from one patient to another. I don't have the time. So basically what I do is I put an order and I say, please call the recovery coach. And when I've identified somebody who has that need, our recovery coaches respond right away. And within an hour, they're in my emergency department to talk to the person in need.
talking with Dr. Julie Denier. She's an emergency medicine specialist in Milwaukee, and Peter Brunzel. He's executive director of WISHOPE. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Did you previously struggle with opioid abuse? What were the steps you took to overcome addiction? You can share your success story. Have you struggled to find support or the right resource to overcome addiction? What do you see in drug recovery coaches? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Peter, how have you seen perhaps the needs change in emergency rooms and their perhaps wanting to have these types of coaches? Because, you know, these recovery coaches have been in hospitals now for a while. Do we see an impact?
Absolutely, we see an impact. Every person that we connect with, we're connecting them to some type of care, whether it is treatment or community resource. And you asked earlier about the difference in, say, a recovery support, community supports versus recovery coach. And this is a good example of how that separation happens. We're going to connect them with a multiple pathway of recovery and allow them to help guide that. And so every single person that we've connected with, which is in the hundreds, has been able to get connected to services of some sort, whether it's community-based or treatment or medical, and we get to walk them through that path and alter if they need it or ask for it.
So with WISHOPE, it provides resources to people fighting opioid addiction. How did you hone in on recovery coaches and that offering, if you will?
Sure. Well, we believe in it. It's called a recovery-oriented system of care. So it's – and peer recovery coaches are a very large part of a recovery-oriented system of care. And somebody named William White writes quite extensively on this topic and a bit of a guru in that area. But and so recovery coaches can offer that support in someone's life before, during, or after, like clinical, medical, community, where they're consistently present and available. And pretty much the insert before – hopefully, because we want to be able to take away from people ending up back in the ER or ending up not making it.
Dr. Denier, we're not just talking about opioids here. There is so much, of course, focused on the opioid epidemic. There's a huge meeting this week in Green Bay on it. What are the other populations you're serving here with recovery coaches? Who has access to recovery coaches?
Every person who walks into the emergency department at our Ascension Wisconsin hospitals. We're excited that the Ascension Wisconsin hospitals are the first in the Milwaukee area to get this grant and to offer this in Milwaukee. And we are specifically now consulting recovery coaches out of Ascension St. Joe's, St. Francis, and Franklin hospitals. In addition to that, the grant is specifically for opiate abuse, and very luckily we were in one of our first meetings and one of the people from Ascension very generously said, why is this just for opiates? We should extend this to people who struggle with benzodiazepines, people who struggle with alcohol. So luckily, Ascension has generously added that we also can call in the recovery coaches for people who struggle with alcohol and any other addiction. So right now we're serving all of those populations at those three hospitals, Ascension, St. Joseph's, St. Francis, and Franklin.
Let's bring in a call now. Monica joining us from Waukesha. Monica, hi. Are you there, Monica? Yeah.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call and for the broadcast. I think it's a very important issue. My comment or my question was, if sometimes when we talk about overdosing, you know, going back especially to the opioid epidemic, when we say overdose, if we are accidentally giving the wrong message or using a word that some people may take as, oh, overdose means too much. People died of too much, but I'm smarter than that. And if I use less, I will be okay. And if we should use it as more as improper use of opioids rather than overdose.
So stigma around words. Dr. Denier, do you want to address that?
We in the medical community put medical words on everything. And one of the important things that I want people to understand is, especially if you're using medications that you've borrowed from a friend, medications that you or opiates that you have gotten off the street. You have no idea what's in that. So even if you think, I've used this before, I can titrate this, I'm not going to hurt myself. Those are the people that we see with accidental overdose. And I realize there is some stigma when you say overdose, you think somebody's trying to hurt themselves. The vast majority of the people we see who come in with with the symptoms of over-medication with opiates are unintentional because it's unregulated what you're getting off the street.
We're talking about drug recovery coaches at some Milwaukee area hospitals. Dr. Julie Denier is an emergency medicine specialist at St. Joseph's Hospital. Peter Brunzel is executive director of WIS Hope. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Up next, it's news, and we'll continue this conversation about addiction recovery coaches right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about drug recovery coaches here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Recovery coaches are peer advocates. They're trained to provide support for others trying to overcome substance abuse. And we're learning about a hospital system that's now staffing drug recovery coaches at 3 Milwaukee area hospitals. Are you in the medical field? What do you see firsthand when it comes to opioid overdoses and opioid addiction? What gaps in care do you see in the system? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Julie Denier is an emergency medicine specialist at St. Joseph's Hospital in Milwaukee, and Peter Brunzel is the executive director of WIS Hope, and that's a nonprofit that provides resources like drug recovery coaches, and they're joining us from the WPR studio in Milwaukee. Peter, going back to you, WIS Hope just finished another training session, which brings the total number of drug recovery coaches to 40 now. What is the training process like?
Sure. The training process is a 5-day curriculum. It's typically 8 hours. Sometimes there's a few extra little things that are added in there. And you can move on through for many other adjunctive trainings once you receive that initial certification as a recovery coach.
Who are some of the types of people who go through this training and want to do this job?
Sure. There's quite a few people. So if you're in recovery and you're looking to support those recovery efforts as a peer in different ways, this is a great way to bring your support to the front lines. And if you're a family member who's affected, you also appear in your own respect, and you can take this training as well.
How much training in counseling are these recovery coaches receiving? Because there's a fair amount of that necessary, I would think, to provide the next steps for a patient who is in crisis.
You're absolutely correct. So they are not counselors. Recovery coaches connect to counseling. They connect to clinical and medical services. They're that go-between a community support and actual clinical or medical staff.
Is this a paid position, or are they volunteers?
It can be both.
Let's go to Richard now, joining us from Loganville. Richard, hi.
Hello.
What's on your mind about recovery coaches?
Well, recovery coaches are great and everything, and I'm all for that. However, they don't realize that millions of people who have been taking opioids for years for very serious things, from spinal injuries and operations, they're denied a lot of their pain management because of this problem. And do we really have to help these people so much that can't say no to these drugs when all of these people who have been using them for many, many years are in really a tough spot because pain management companies have been saying, well, I'm sorry, you can't have that now.
And yeah, let's get Dr. Denier to respond to that. How do we support those with chronic pain like Richard?
I That's a great question. And to go back to this, we have to look at years and years ago about how this came to be, how we've treated chronic pains chronic pain primarily with opiates. And I'm going to go back. I'm an old person. I've been in the ER. I've been working in ERs for over 30 years. In 1996, OxyContin was introduced and sold to me and to all of my my physician counterparts as a non-addictive medication for chronic pain. That was followed closely in 1998 by the Joint Commission, which is kind of our governing body, saying pain is the fifth vital sign. So every time we see somebody in the hospital, we get their heart rate, their respiratory rate, their temperature, and their blood pressure. In 1998, we added to that a pain scale. So every person that we saw, we needed to look at that pain scale and treat that number. So we have this great drug that we think is non-addictive. We have this thing that we need to do. So the real thought in medicine, and the reason for this is we wanted to treat patients well, is there were more and more and more opiate prescriptions written. And that just kind of snowballed over the years. We realized over the last, 10 years or so, that opiates are not a great medication for chronic pain. And but they are a good medication. We still use them all the time in the emergency department. So our push was, number one, to prescribe less, and to number two, really try to find alternates to opiates. I'm working together with Ascension. We have an opiate task force to treat pain appropriately. We know that every single patient has their own needs, and pain is a horrible thing to deal with. So we need to look at the best way to treat pain for each person. And that may mean taking people from opiates and treating them with better medication. And studies have shown that other medications that are not as addictive can work really, really well for chronic pain. However, through no fault of their own, people who take chronic pain medications become physically addicted. It's not a judgment on them. They are not junkies, nothing bad about that. But it's just a nature of the medication. So we need to see each patient as a person, figure out how best to treat their pain, and see if there's a possibility to do that without opiates.
So we're prescribing less. We're looking for alternatives. We're being very careful about what we prescribe. Are you seeing any measurable changes from your vantage point on the opioid epidemic in your ERs?
Recently, the state of Wisconsin has put together a prescription drug monitoring program, which has been a great tool for us to help figure out that we're treating patients appropriately. And since that's been put into to use, we've noted that prescriptions of opiates have gone down at least 30% in the first year the PDMP was out. I'm not sure where the numbers have gone since then, but there was a significant drop in prescriptions written.
You were awarded this $75,000 grant to provide support for people after they leave the emergency room. I'm wondering, how did you and Wis Hope collaborate on this grant? And then before this program, how did the ER address these people in crisis overdose situations and addiction?
Prior to our collaboration, we would identify people with a need, we would treat them as best we could medically, and we would direct them to outpatient management. I will admit, and maybe this is a little too personal, I've been in the emergency department for a long time, and I love my job. We are in a great place. We see people when they're born, when they die, and wonderful things that happen in between. I work with wonderful people. I identified really that I was becoming pretty jaded and walking into every room a few years ago thinking, oh, what do you want? I reflected a little bit, and this patients coming in looking for opiates, patients with recidivism, kind of was getting me down. So decided that I need to make some changes. And part of those changes was to go back to school to get my master's in public health. And through that journey, went to a presentation in Madison where Jessica Gursky spoke. And she was with Wisconsin Voices for recovery. And she spoke about the recovery coach program that was being piloted. I listened to her story. I thought, this is what we need. So wrote a grant and we got it. And it was so exciting. And it was because of I just heard about this awesome pilot and just thought, this is a tool that we need in our hospitals.
Talking with Dr. Julie Denier. She's with St. Joseph's Hospital in Milwaukee, an emergency medicine specialist. Peter Brunzel is executive director of WISHOPE. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or someone you love have a problem with opioid abuse? What's your story? Did you previously struggle with opioid abuse? What are the steps you took to overcome addiction, and who helped along your journey? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Peter, you've actually struggled with addiction yourself. Can you tell us your story and how you came to where you are today?
Sure. Through my youth, I used quite a plethora of different things. And pretty quickly, I realized that I was becoming addicted and that seemed like a better alternative to the life that I was leading at that point. By the time I was 17 years old, after quite a few visits to boys' homes, shelter cares, living on the streets, I ended up being waved over to adult court, and I sat in the county jail in isolation for 90 days because I wasn't 18. And so waiting for conviction, I was facing about 60 years of prison time. And I saw the writing on the wall. There was people in my life as I was growing up that did kind of walk in the world a little different. They didn't seem to have what I had going on inside me. They seemed at peace. And I thought maybe while I was sitting in that isolation that maybe I could reach that place too in my life and find some sort of peace and walk like they did. So since then I had a dream even while I was there as a 17-year-old young man, and that was in 1993, that I would be able to live my life to give back and to all the people, even the ones that I sat next to using drugs with. How could I serve? What could I do? How could I help them see what I'm seeing? Because obviously life is much more wonderful to live than to demolish, so with drugs and alcohol.
What resources were available during your recovery and at that time when you struggled most?
Back then, it was a little bit different. Mm-hmm. The doors have opened up quite a bit more for a young man my age trying to find recovery. I ended up serving 2 years in jail instead of the 60, and I had 6 years probation. And I just used any resource that was around me. Really, I used the county, I used the community supports, and anything that I could because I wanted to find that path that I saw, that little glimpse of hope that I had, and to keep moving toward it. Nowadays, there's so many more resources available, and being able to do things like this and offer recovery coaching to our communities is a wonderful opportunity for other people to give back and live in that space.
Learning about the work of drug recovery coaches in an effort to stem the opioid abuse epidemic. Joining us are Dr. Julie Denier. She is an emergency medicine specialist at St. Joseph's Hospital in Milwaukee. Peter Brunzel is executive director of WISHOPE. Are you with an organization that helps people struggling with opioid abuse? What advice can you share to fight addiction? What resources does your organization provide to help those abusing drugs? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're learning about drug recovery coaches in some hospital systems here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is hundreds of healthcare providers are in Green Bay right now for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services two-day forum on the state's opioid crisis. Since the early 2000s, Wisconsin has experienced a surge in opioid abuse, with the overdose rate increasing more than fivefold. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the state's rate of drug and opioid overdose deaths per 1,000 population exceeds the national average. And Ascension Hospital System hopes to help in the treatment and recovery of people suffering from opioid addiction through this pilot program that it's staffing drug recovery coaches at 3 Milwaukee area hospitals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Julie Denier is an emergency medicine specialist at St. St. Joseph's Hospital in Milwaukee, and Peter Brunzel is Executive Director of WIS Hope. They stay with us. Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Steve joining us from Toma. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. I was, very successful. I'm 40 years old. I had a six-figure salary, well-educated, great family life growing up, Christian and all that. And I was in an accident. I ended up getting addicted to Oxycontin. Tried to wean me off. And the withdrawals I can't describe. They will make someone who is a good person, who is, do things that they would never normally do. I was suicidal to the point where, I couldn't find it on the street, and I didn't want to use heroin. I couldn't find heroin. I mean, I was going to use heroin for the first time because the withdrawals are so bad. I lost my job. I lost my savings.
Steve, what was your turning point?
I always wanted to stop. It was just the withdrawals. I couldn't control them, and I couldn't work.
Where did you go for help?
I ended up finding a program in La Crosse, and they basically got me on a replacement therapy and counseling, and I'm still on the replacement, but I finally have a job. I'm building my savings back up. I ended up getting divorced because of it, but I can't say enough about the Suboxone and what that did for me. And,
Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you.
Yeah, I'm just saying that it gave me the, I was going to go rob a store. I mean, it was that crazy. And for society, I think the replacement therapy, if someone's ready, is the answer to get them back as a contributing member.
Let's get Dr. Denier in here. What do you hear in Steve's story?
Just wow. First of all, Steve, congratulations. And I think Peter and I can talk forever. Your story is just indicative of what this drug does to people. This is a drug that affects everybody, all socioeconomic classes across the board. And the withdrawal symptoms are so horrible that it makes people do things to get the drug. And I think you've said it more eloquently than I ever could. And that's why we are so driven to help, because this is such a difficult drug to get over. So congratulations. And you are exactly why we are doing this, why we're doing what we're doing. So congratulations to you.
Peter, in Dane County, drug recovery coaches have been in place since 2016. What have hospitals been seeing in terms of the impact of these coaches? Are you watching and measuring this?
We absolutely are. So WIS Hope and Ascension are part of a broader effort of the creation of educational materials for the ED staff as well as patients, in addition to collecting evidence-based data of the impact of these types of recovery supports to our community. So as we do that, and that's through Wisconsin Voices of Recovery, and this particular grant, it did come from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services to Wisconsin Voices for exact efforts like this to collect these evidence-based data.
Let's go to Jennifer now, joining us from ArborVita. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I know there's not much time left. I happen to be a chaplain for hospice in a hospital system in northern Wisconsin, and I know that the spiritual services departments have some really fine chaplains and psychosocial staff that I hope would be invited into this process, because often the root causes of the addiction are some deep spiritual distress and deep emotional pain, and just wanted to put that out there.
Jennifer, thanks for the call. Peter, what about chaplains in the recovery process?
They're a huge support. We have so many people that are chaplains, ministers, priests that we're connected to in our communities. Anytime anybody's opening up their arms to embrace another human is a great expression of what's needed in this field right now.
How long, Peter, do these recovery coaches stay with their patient and stay with the person who is in need? What does that timeline look like? When do they let go?
They let go typically when there's a wellness factor happening. So there is a little there's a platform that they work off of. But it could go on for a year. It could go on for two. And it also obviously does depend on funding as well. So but it could go on as long as a year or two.
Dr. Denier, your ER is also providing addicts with another new resource. Can you tell us about these kits going home with patients who have overdosed?
Yes, I'm very excited about this. Another thing that we've realized is that when overdoses happen, there's a lag time. Somebody needs to call an ambulance to get naloxone administered. So what naloxone is, or Narcan, you may have heard, is a opiate antagonist. If given after somebody's accidentally overdosed, it reverses the sedation effect. So somebody who is accidentally overdosed, who stopped breathing or their heart stops, because they've stopped breathing, if they're administered Narcan in a timely manner, that reverses and people wake up. And it's a great drug, but if it's not given in a timely manner, there can be anoxic brain injury, people can die, they can have debility. Disability. So our newest plan is we are going to be educating our providers and to educate our patients. So if somebody comes in and we've identified them as having an opiate addiction or having too many opiates prescribed or having we think that they're at risk for possible accidental overdose, we will actually give them a kit and teach them how to use it. So they will walk out with a kit, and mostly in thanks to Ascension has given us a $5,000 grant just for that, specifically just so we can have people walk out with this medication in their hand. Because I've realized when I became interested in this, I actually went pharmacy to pharmacy around my house to try to get Narcan myself. I have insurance, and pretty good insurance, I think. Even for myself, it was anywhere from $40 to $80 to buy the naloxone. If somebody had a prescription, I think that's pretty prohibitive. So I really think it's important for people to walk out with a kit so it's available at the time of overdose in order to save lives.
Dr. Denier, what happens after this year grant is up and you're looking ahead on these drug recovery coaches?
We are right now applying for another year of this, and my hope is that we become sustainable. My hope is that we prove this is a benefit to a patient. My hope is that the state recognizes this, it becomes something that's supported by Medicaid. But I think that's what our pilot program is. Our job is to prove that this is a helpful tool.
Peter, as we wrap up, if someone listening right now is going through addiction, is in crisis, what do you want them to know?
Absolutely. Well, one, that there is help. And if you simply want to reach out and just have a conversation with somebody, or you're looking for resources, you can call our hotline, 844-WIS-HOPE. If you just simply want to peruse for yourself and find the resources in your area, you can go to www.wishope.org. We have a resource map for all of Wisconsin on our website, and that they're not alone. And there definitely is hope. So,
Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Dr. Denier, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Julie Denier is an emergency medicine specialist at St. Joseph Hospital in Milwaukee, part of the Ascension Healthcare System. Peter Brunzel is executive director of WisHope. That's a nonprofit based in Waukesha County. And just ahead, they joined us, by the way, from our WPR studio in Milwaukee. Just ahead, open floor plans became more popular with the growth of the suburbs, but now some homeowners want their walls back. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.